From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Cleveland is reportedly emptying its jail cells, moving inmates out of the city, preparing to keep its courts open till 1 a.m. in anticipation of the Republican National Convention, which starts with a huge welcoming party on Sunday and is expected to see protests during the week. Donald Trump will announce his VP pick tomorrow at 11 a.m. And today his campaign released a list of convention speakers as new polls show the race tightening between Trump and Hillary Clinton after her scolding by the FBI director over her use of emails. So let's jump right in. Let's start this hour with NPR's lead politics editor, Domenico Montanaro. Hi, Domenico.
Hello.
So what do you think of the list? It's got he said it was going to be non-conventional speakers, and it sort of is.
It's certainly unconventional. You don't have a ton of Republican congressmen or leaders, certainly fewer than 2012. You do have a host of them, including Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell and House Speaker Paul Ryan and some of the people that that Donald Trump ran against in the primary, including Ted Cruz, Ben Carson, some senators and others. But you also have this other group of folks, including retired quarterback Tim Tebow, Natalie Gulbis, a professional golfer, two of the Benghazi survivors, a Vegas casino owner, the PayPal founder. So the Trump campaign says this is a cross-section of people facing a variety of different issues in the country and who support Donald Trump.
Well, let's do a little more of the looking at the tea leaves, because people are. And we know, for instance, that some of the candidates, Mike Pence, for instance, Indiana Governor Mike Pence, is not on the list of speakers. Do we make
sense of that? Huh?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think a lot of people will read into that. I mean, if you look at the fact that Newt Gingrich is on the list and Chris Christie is on the list, two of the people who are supposed to be finalists along with Mike Pence, then you can conclude by default that Mike Pence is the likely pick to be the vice presidential nominee. Of course, I would just say and caution folks that Donald Trump is known to try to gin up something, and he said that he wants to surprise people. So who knows? That's where I think the smart money is, and people can look at it and look at Mike Pence as the person, given that he's not on this list. But again, Trump known for head fakes, so let's see.
Well, and let's speculate, because everyone is, and we're going to find out tomorrow. What do you make of, you know, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie was in the lead many times, but did he lose points because of his history with Donald Trump's son-in-law, who's, you know, been so close to this campaign, Jared Kushner? 12 years ago, Christie prosecuted Kushner's father, Charles, for making illegal campaign contributions, evading taxes. Very sore tender point. Is it possible that he could be a vice president with that history with the family?
Well, he's certainly been close to Trump during this campaign. That isn't something that's really come up in the course of this campaign. You know, the problem with Chris Christie for Donald Trump is that you're doubling down on two brash Northeasterners. And, you know, in polling, the only people who have a favorable opinion of Chris Christie are Republicans in the Northeast, and that's certainly a small group.
What do you think of the polling that shows such a tight race, especially in swing states?
Well, look, the polling in swing states certainly shows that the FBI investigation, James Comey coming out and kind of thwacking Hillary Clinton, has taken a bite out of her. Now, she's still ahead. She's still probably the favorite in this race. But I think people, as you get closer to an election and get closer to a convention, people put on their blue and red jerseys. And I think you're starting to see some of that.
Yeah. But the Rules Committee is meeting today. Many Republicans who oppose Trump are seeing it as their last chance to find a way to have someone other than Trump at the top of the ticket. What do you think is going to come out of this Rules Committee meeting?
And there are a lot of behind-the-scenes machinations going on right now as we speak. Mm-hmm. And there's a super-secret meeting that's going on between leaders of the, quote, Never Trump movement, who are meeting behind the scenes with RNC leaders like Reince Priebus. Reince Priebus would like to get this all wrapped up and make sure that there isn't some scene on the floor. He's trying to, you know, give some procedural compromise to make them feel good. There's no necessarily, sure shot here that they're going to accept anything like that. And it should be noted that they adjourned earlier this morning because of a printer jam. that printer jam just so happened to coincide with this super secret meeting, however.
Oh, okay. Before we get just about a minute here, and I just want to touch on the Ruth Bader Ginsburg dust up. This is, yep, of course, Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg making very derogatory comments three times about Donald Trump. He's been demanding an apology. Today, she offered that apology. In effect, she said, "I shouldn't have said that."
Yeah, she said that she regrets her ill-advised comments and said that she should be more circumspect. Now, the definition of the word circumspect essentially means that I'll keep my thoughts to myself next time.
Well, but what is
so
that?
She's not apologizing by saying, you know, Donald Trump is qualified to be president. She certainly has expressed her opinion on that.
I know, but what does that say? There are a lot of people who felt that, you know, as other Supreme Court justices have either mouthed, you know, insults or said them behind closed doors and they've leaked out. In other words, they've been known to say them. One sat at the Fox News table at one of those Washington events. You know, people have felt she had the right to say it.
Well, and Antonin Scalia had, you know, gone duck hunting with Dick Cheney, for example. But there usually is at least a veneer in modern Supreme Court times where you don't actually go ahead and say something so you don't appear to have a conflict.
NPR's lead politics editor, Domenico Montanaro, we're going to hear a lot from you over the next several days. Thank you.
You're welcome.
And good news, we've just cleared the paper jam in our printer here at Here and Now.
Well, we can continue.
We can continue. Mexico is making it harder to import used cars from the U.S. There are hundreds of Mexican auto importers along the border whose livelihoods depend on moving America's rejects into Mexico. But Mexican customs agents have abruptly reduced their hours and the number of cars that they will let through, which has a lot of people angry. Monica Ortiz Uribe from the Fronteras desk at KJZZ in Phoenix reports.
A sorry parade of banged up cars idle bumper to bumper near a remote border crossing outside El Paso. There's hundreds of them lined up farther than the eye can see. Some have smashed windshields and missing headlights, others dented hoods held shut by bungee cords. All are waiting to cross into Mexico.
Tengo ya 5 días queriendo importar aquella camioneta, aquellos dos vehículos.
I've been waiting 5 days to import these two cars, says Gerardo Roman. He's part of an entire economic sector along the border dedicated to the revival and resale of clunkers from the U.S. In the last decade, Mexico received more than 7 million used cars from north of the border. Backlog of these cars at ports of entry in California and Texas has sparked chaos. Last month in Ciudad Juarez, angry import salesmen blocked commercial traffic coming into Mexico for several hours. At a border crossing south of San Diego, the Tijuana Chamber of Commerce counted as many as 4,000 cars waiting to be imported. Customs is strangling commerce at the border for arbitrary reasons, says Eloisa Talavera. She's a Mexican congresswoman from the border state of Baja California. The head of Mexico's customs agency attributed the delays at the border to stricter inspections in an effort to crack down on illegal imports. Those are cars whose values are deliberately underestimated to evade taxes or cars with fake emissions reports. But importers suspect customs officials of caving into pressure from Mexico's domestic auto manufacturing industry, whose sales lag behind the used car industry. These two industries must learn to coexist, says Talavera. While new car sales have remained relatively stagnant in the last decade, the automotive industry isn't necessarily suffering for it. On the contrary, Mexico is Latin America's number one auto exporter. Major brands like Ford, Nissan, and Toyota have factories there. In the last 5 years, Mexico exported 14 million cars, mostly to the U.S. Eduardo Solis is president of Mexico's Auto Manufacturers Association. He says the only pressure they're putting on Mexican authorities is to go after illegal car imports.
Es mucha la basura vehicular que nos llegó de Estados Unidos a través de certificados de emisiones falsos.
Too much trash from the U.S. ends up on our streets, Solis says. If a vehicle isn't fit to be driven in the U.S., he says, it shouldn't be allowed on Mexico's streets. At a neighborhood body shop in Juarez, a worker repaints an imported Chevy Silverado cherry red. Other cars in the shop still have registration stickers from Minnesota, New Jersey, and Massachusetts. One even has a bumper sticker for ex-presidential candidate Ben Carson.
Pues yo aquí tengo trabajando toda mi vida en esto de los carros, más de 20 años aquí.
Juan Flores is a second-generation salesman who's been selling U.S. imports for 20 years. He says they make car ownership a reality for low-wage Mexicans who don't have access to credit. But at the moment, sales are down. Mexico's peso is weak against the U.S. dollar right now, making his cars more expensive. We're trying to make miracles, he says. His used car shop is among dozens that line both sides of a major street in Juarez. In the coming months, representatives of auto importers from multiple border states hope to help legislators craft new laws that will better regulate the flow of used cars coming from the U.S. For Here and Now, I'm Monica Ortiz Uribe.
The National Park Service turns 100 years old this August, so this summer we're taking a tour of some of the country's national parks. Today, Acadia National Park in Maine, which is celebrating its centennial this year along with the National Park Service. We're joined by Kevin Schneider, superintendent of Acadia National Park. Welcome.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And for people who have never been there, first of all, just describe the park for us.
Well, Acadia is where the mountains meet the sea. It's this beautiful landscape of mountains that reach the ocean. It preserves the rocky cliffs of Maine and just this spectacular place. It's a great place for families to come visit. We were just named as best national park for families. A great place for hikers, for bicyclers, for people just wanting to spend some time along the coast.
And it was established back in 1916. How did it become a national park?
Well, Acadia became a national park through private philanthropy. It was the first national park in the United States created by very generous individuals who realized that this place should be preserved as a park for all Americans. And they began to purchase land. It was John D. Rockefeller Jr. and George B. Dorr and Charles Elliott really working together to make this place a park for all Americans.
And what do Americans do there? When people arrive at the park these days, what do you tell them to do?
Well, it's a fabulous place to get out on one of our carriage roads. The carriage roads were actually personally designed by John D. Rockefeller Jr. And people can walk, they can bicycle, they can go jogging. Just the carriage roads are a phenomenal resource. To go for a walk on one of the trails, there's more than 130 miles of trails here in Acadia. And so you can hike up to these spectacular mountains, places like Sergeant Peak or Cadillac Mountain, and see these phenomenal vistas of Maine's islands and this beautiful pastoral landscape and the ocean.
What kind of wildlife do you find in Acadia National Park?
There's deer, there's raccoons that people see in our campground. You can go tide pooling in our intertidal areas and look for little sea creatures in these beautiful intertidal locations. So it's also a great place to see wildlife.
What about plants? A lot of interesting plants in Acadia.
There are, and so Acadia is known for a diversity of plant life. What concerns us is that 20% of the plants that existed when the park was created are actually now not found in Acadia National Park. So, you know, we're trying to understand the causation behind that. You know, climate change is probably part of it. There are other factors in play as well, though.
But what kind of plants? If I were to come there, where would you take me to show me some of the interesting plants you have?
Well, we have beautiful forest types, spruce, fir, you know, combined with hardwood forests. We've got ferns that are spectacular. Our forests are kind of characterized by having these mossy rocks. And so it's sort of a almost like a rainforest, but not quite.
Do you face the problems that some other parks are facing right now, which is that there are too many people coming, that people want to go to the park, and it's actually disturbing some of the nature and some of the wildlife in the park?
Well, our visitation year to date is up 21%. So we've been very, very busy this summer. I think we're going to break a record this year for the most visitors ever in a year to Acadia. In fact, months of April, May, and June were all the busiest months on record for those months in our history. And so, you know, business is very good here, and that's really a good problem to have. You know, we're glad that people are coming to Acadia National Park, but we also want to make sure they have a really good experience when they get here. So we're encouraging people to ride the Island Explorer, which is a bus system that moves throughout the park, and it's a fare-free bus system, so it's a great way to get out and enjoy the park. We're encouraging people to leave their car at their hotel, you know, walk to the park, ride their bicycles, or ride the bus, and kind of leave their car behind.
What are some of the hidden secrets in the park or things that you think are underappreciated by the visitors?
You know, many people want to go up to Cadillac Mountain for sunrise, but there are other locations in the park that are equally as spectacular, such as Ocean Drive. You know, you can go along Ocean Drive and find a location for sunrise and almost have the place to yourself. And so many people are sort of attracted to these iconic experiences, but by exploring a little deeper and learning a little bit more about the park, which you can do just by going to one of our visitor centers and talking to a ranger, you can really have the place to yourself if that's what you're looking for.
What do you find interesting still today about Acadia since you've been there now for a while?
To me, what makes Acadia special is the opportunity to really get out into the park, whether it's on a bicycle, on a carriage road, or go for a hike, to spend time with my family along the ocean, whether, again, that's at Sand Beach or at another location. You know, this is a great place to get out and experience nature.
Best hike in Acadia?
The best hike in Acadia, you know, I think there are a number that could fit that description. Really getting up on top of any of the park's peaks is going to be a phenomenal experience. You know, spending the time and the effort walking up to the top of one of the park's mountains is phenomenal. And you just get these tremendous views of the oceans, the islands, and the landscape.
And is the peak time to do that sunrise? Is that when everybody shows up right before dawn?
You know, I don't think you have to necessarily try to do it at sunrise. I think there are a lot of great times to be in the park. Sunset's beautiful as well. You know, the morning hours are always nice. The evening hours are wonderful. But really, it's about going for a walk, spending time with your family, your friends, on a trail, and getting your heart rate up a little bit, too.
That's Kevin Schneider, superintendent of Acadia National Park in Maine. Kevin, thanks.
Thank you, Jeremy.
And I'm sure Acadia National Park is also the site of more than a few Pokemon Go players, the smartphone game that's been capturing a lot of attention. It uses GPS and augmented reality technology to send players out into the real world in search of fictional Pokemon creatures to capture and battle. The Pokemon are usually drawn to public areas of interest, including, unfortunately, Arlington National Cemetery, the Holocaust Museum in Washington, and the Auschwitz Memorial in Poland. They have all asked players to refrain from playing the game there and are calling on the game's publisher and maker, Nintendo and Niantic, to take their locations out of the field of play. Kurt Wagner is senior editor of social media at Recode. He joins us via Skype from San Francisco. And Kurt, what is wrong with people, and should we have seen this coming?
Yeah, we probably should have seen this coming, to be honest with you. I mean, the fact that these Pokemon are out in the real world and there are a lot of places where you would not necessarily – it would not be, you know, culturally or socially appropriate to bring your phone and play, such as a memorial like this, or, you know, people are playing at police stations, churches, all kinds of different things. And I think it still caught some people off guard.
And I wondered, actually, when I saw that they were playing at the Auschwitz Memorial in Poland, how does that work? Because when we spoke with you the other day, one of the things we talked about was that this game is only available at this point in the U.S., Australia, and New Zealand.
Right. So there are a few ways, especially if you have an Android device, that you can download the game through some third-party websites that are not the Google Play Store. So there is a bit of a workaround that people all over the world have been using up until now. Obviously, the game is going to officially launch in a few other places. I believe it even went to the UK just recently, maybe in the last 24 hours or so. So, but people had been going around that until now, and so that's how they have the game on the phone.
So I've never played this game, and I just wonder, is it so captivating that you sort of lose all of your other thoughts about what's appropriate in society?
I don't know if this game is unique in that way. There are probably people using their phones at these places all the time. This just happens to be right. The thing that they're using their phone to do right now, right? So, I mean, because it is a more visual game, because it, you know, there's AR involved, so it's literally projecting these Pokemon into the real world, it just looks a lot worse than when you're just simply texting on your phone.
Now, let's talk about the other side of this, which is that this is bringing more foot traffic into places where there wasn't as much foot traffic before. And there was an analyst today, Oliver Chen of Cowen and Company, talking about the idea that Pokemon Go has the power to transform retail and could revive dying shopping malls because it's bringing people in if retailers can figure out a way to capitalize on all that traffic.
I think it's a fun idea, and this whole notion of, you know, the fact that it is tied to a map, and that if you, you know, say want to catch a rare Pokemon or show up at some kind of important point within the game, maybe a business would pay to host that at their store. So all of a sudden you have people walking in the door because they want to battle one another and they need to be in this specific location to do so. I think, you know, what's going to be, I guess the challenge here is how quickly can they build that into the app, and B, how long does this app really stay relevant, right? Mm. By the time they ultimately come out and figure out a way for me to have to show up at my, you know, downtown Nordstrom to get this rare Pokemon I really want, are people still going to be playing the game? I don't really know. I would imagine this is going to take months to implement. And by that point, a lot of the, I guess, excited folks who just jumped on to test it out right now may be gone.
Well, that was my next question. We had a colleague here who said, this is a fad. What is the sense inside of Techland where you are and at Recode about whether this is here to stay or is a fad?
Well, I think it will be a fad, but I think there will continue to be a very devoted user base moving forward. I don't necessarily think 6 months from now no one will be playing Pokemon Go. I do think there's a lot of people, probably like myself, to be honest, who signed up because had played Pokemon in the past, wanted to see what everyone was talking about. All of a sudden, you know, other things come up, life gets in the way, and you don't want to be playing video games all the time. But there will be a small collection, or who knows how big, a collection of people who play this religiously and for a long time. And I just don't think it's going to be nearly as widespread as it is right now when we're talking about it 6 months from now.
That's Kurt Wagner, a senior editor of social media at Recode. Kurt, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
And Pokemon Go players, just use your judgment.
Happy Bastille Day! Woohoo! Biggest national holiday in France. Also the 12th day of that country's most famous sporting event, the Tour de France. And today's race was a doozy. After a crash, the race leader was seen running up a hill. It's been 4 years since race organizers stripped Lance Armstrong of his 7 consecutive Tour de France titles because of doping. So let's take a look with Mike Pesca, here now sports analyst and host of the daily podcast The Gist at Slate.com. Mike, happy Bastille Day!
Oh, thank you.
You're welcome.
You too.
Not so happy for Chris Froome, though. I mean, he won last year, and like I said, he was seen running up Mont Ventoux after he crashed into a bike that crashed into a motorbike. Some of the riders are saying, everyone's all over the road, it's a mess, they have to do something about this.
Yeah, well, Froome is two-time winner. He won in 2013 also, and I'll quote from a BBC reporter, Chris Osborne, a bonkers, bonkers, bonkers day of cycling. So the spectators gathered so closely that it created a jam, and you can even see the video of the Australian rider who crashes into the motor car. Chain reaction, Froome loses his bike, so he starts running up the hill. They're a half mile from the finish line. This is not the best way to go about winning the Tour de France, though. In the rules, it says a rider can cross the finish line without a bike if he's carrying the bike. So they're not explicit on wheels on the ground or feet on the ground.
And let me try to get a bike, but they were too small, so he's hopping on bikes. Can't
find
a bike
yet. Changed bikes, and he would have lost the yellow jersey and been behind by a lot, but they went and they clarified it. It was not his fault, and so now he's still in the lead. Do yourself a favor. If you could find some of the commentary on this, it is crazy.
Okay, we'll post it. But meanwhile, I want to ask you, because one of the big concerns, we talked about doping, and this year, officials are using these infrared cameras to catch cyclists who are using tiny electric motors attached to bicycle wheels. This is called mechanical doping or moto doping. I'm looking at a picture of one of these disguised as a television cameras, you know, infrared cameras. Is this really still happening?
Well, they did catch a female rider in an under 23 event, and some Italian riders were caught. But it does seem that unlike the cat and mouse game between medical doping or drug doping, this one, there are good ways of cracking down on it. The infrared cameras do sense when motors are being used. And they also really very much seem to be intent on scanning all the bikes. And I think the top riders are not part of this moto doping.
Well, it's such a crazy thing. I mean, what if you went too fast and suddenly you're like, woo, you're taking off? It would seem obvious to other riders who know how fast you go.
I think where it would be useful is one of these mountains. And so today's mountain phase, Ventoux, that's one of the toughest mountains, if not the toughest in the tour. And but for the crash, we'd be talking about, you know, the amount of oxygen, the amount of work. So just what does a motor do? A motor is a machine that does work. Any amount of work that can be taken away from the rider and put onto a machine can be helpful and possibly undetectable without the cameras.
And giving you a little bit of a rest while you're still pedaling. Well, Chris Froome, do you think he will get the lead again?
He has extended his lead on the number two rider from last year. He's a really, really strong rider. The French also have this aesthetic sense about things and never liked him. They thought he was too safe. But this year he's attacking. So they're applauding him on the podium. So he might win and he might actually become popular.
Mike Beska, Hair Now sports analyst. He could try running, too.
Biathlon.
The daily podcast at justatslate.com. Thank you.
You're welcome.
We don't yet know who the vice presidential nominees will be, although there is a lot of talk out there. We do know that a number of baby boomers are in the running and that the two major party candidates for president are from the older end of the baby boom generation, a retaking of the baton from Barack Obama, who was just 47 when he took office. William Howell is a professor of political science at the University of Chicago. He joins us for more on this. Welcome.
Good to be with you.
Well, what do you think? Does it matter that these two candidates, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, come from a particular generation, the baby boomer generation, in terms of the views that they bring to the table and how they see the world?
It matters in some ways. I think the big ticket items when you think about elections, presidential elections, have more to do with the state of the economy, how popular the sitting president is, whether or not we're at war, these kind of macro features. But when you drill down a bit and you think about how a campaign is run and the positions that people take, age and the generations from which people come can play a role, and it may well play a role in the coming election.
Well, when I think of the baby boomer generation, I think that these people have certain things that they've experienced in their lives, certain very important things. We've heard a lot of comparisons recently between now and the late 60s. Of course, the baby boomers lived through the post-war period. They lived through the hippie generation. They saw all the trouble in the 60s with the assassinations of the Kennedys and Martin Luther King Jr. And then they saw the nation go into a very controversial war in Vietnam. How do those things, do you think, play into the views of these politicians of this generation?
Well, they do have different cultural and political reference points. I think in the main, though, what we see is that people who are younger, millennials today, but this has been true for a long time, tend to be more liberal than are people who are older. And so what you see is you referenced a bunch of points about, you know, the civil rights movement and and reactions against the Vietnam War, which would suggest that the baby boomers are actually rather liberal in their orientation. But what we see is in the main, people as they age, they become more conservative.
So are we then, as a result of the fact that we have two candidates from this generation, one of whom is 70 and one who will be 70 next year, that they're more conservative than we otherwise would be if we had younger candidates?
Well, it's hard to know. The person who captured the attention in the primaries of millennials was Bernie Sanders, who, had he gotten the nomination, he would have been the oldest nominee from either the Democrats or Republicans going back over 70 years at 74. And the reason, though, he captured the attention of people who are young is not because he was – it had nothing to do with his age. It had to do with the positions that he was taking. So I don't think there's this natural translation of the age that people have and the positions that they take among candidates.
So if the young are so interested in the message of Bernie Sanders, why do you think that the two people who survived that entire grueling primary process this year are from the same generation, the baby boomer generation, and that nobody in Gen X, let's say, because the millennials probably not old enough yet to be in the White House just based on the laws. Why is it that there was no talent from Gen X that got to that point?
Well, on the Democratic side, there wasn't a player. And I think early on, Hillary Clinton had lots of structural advantages for why she was going to be the nominee. Now, on the Republican side, you had 16, 17 candidates in play. And the question that political observers around the country have been baffled over for the last 6 months is, how is it that Donald Trump rose to the top? Now, I don't think that Donald Trump rising to the top had much to do with his age. He didn't stand up for the interests of the baby boomer generation, and yet there he is as one of their members.
So what do you think this means for the country? Because there is a lot of criticism, especially from the younger generation, of this baby boomer generation, of a sort of a selfishness, an inability to invest in the future. A lot of these young people are coming out of college with a lot of debt, and the country has a lot of debt that the younger generation had nothing to do with.
This is true, and these are precisely the kinds of concerns that Bernie Sanders raised in his campaign, which again is why he captivated the imaginations and support of so many young people around the country. Again, young people lean left, and Hillary Clinton is poised to capture their support. We'll see whether or not she can pull it off.
Do you think that presidents represent their generation if you look back over the history of the other presidents?
You know, it's interesting. Republicans routinely nominate people who are older. On average, they're about 60 years old, as opposed to Democrats who nominate people who are younger, on average 54. Hmm. And Donald Trump would be the fourth oldest Republican nominee behind McCain, Dole, and Reagan. The extent to which those people represented their interests of their generation as compared to younger people, I think it's a hard call. I think there's certainly some individuals who we can point to who captivated the sensibilities of people who are young, John F. Kennedy being the quintessential example, who was nominated at the age of 43, Bill Clinton to an extent at 46, and Barack Obama as well at 47. But we're painting with really broad brushstrokes when we say the extent to which an individual candidate represents the broad views of an entire generation. I think there certainly are some candidates who captivated the attentions and imaginations of the young. But whether or not they routinely do, I think, is an open question.
That's William Howell, a political science professor at the University of Chicago. Thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
And we'd love to hear your thoughts on this at our website, hereandnow.org. Well, as solar power gains more popularity around the country, utilities are struggling to adjust, including in Vermont, where last fall, the largest utility reached the cap for the number of new solar projects it can hook up to the grid. That means some new projects won't get built this year. Kathleen Masterson of Here and Now contributor Vermont Public Radio reports.
There we go. That's probably him.
Hey. Hey, Chris.
Hey.
Good. How are you?
Good. Good. The whole gang's here.
Indeed. I just put on some water for coffee, if you'd like.
Okay.
It's not the best day to sell solar power. There's a cold and bleak fog blanketing the landscape, and it's raining. But Dan Kinney of Catamount Solar assures me this hillside in Vermont is well suited.
There's kind of a myth that Vermont doesn't have enough sun to make solar viable. Well, that's crazy. The most solar in the world is in Germany, and you don't think of a lot of people going to Germany to get suntans.
The neighbors, there's actually two houses that you see that neighbor there. But
we head out to a southward sloping right hill where a group of residents from the little town of South Royalton want to build a community solar array. 32 people and businesses have expressed interest in the venture. But like other solar projects hoped for this year, it's a no-go. At least for now. That's because last fall, Vermont's largest utilities reached their cap for accepting new solar projects in their net metering programs. Net metering allows homeowners to generate power from renewable energy sources and sell excess power to utility companies. Lawmakers approved the measure back in 1998 as a way to jumpstart the construction of small-scale renewable energy projects.
Some of the reason why we hit the cap so soon was a large percentage of our capacity was filled by larger projects.
That's Andrea Cohen, a spokesperson for Vermont Electric Co-op, the state's second largest utility, which hit its 2016 net metering cap back in the fall of 2015.
The cap was put in place to limit the financial exposure that utilities and ratepayers might see while they were figuring out how net metering was really going to work and get deployed and how quickly.
Chris Wood says the cap hurts community solar projects. Wood works for the South Royalton nonprofit Building a Local Economy, or BALE. He says a big part of community solar is allowing people to invest in solar energy even if they can't install panels on their own property. He says the South Royalton market would like to invest in renewable energy for environmental reasons and to make a dent in their $2,700 a month electricity bill.
They would like to take a chunk out of paying that huge bill, but obviously they can't put solar on their roof. They don't have access. So this community solar will allow them to buy into solar without having to sort of do it on their property.
James Moore, co-president of Sun Common, the largest residential solar installer in Vermont, says when it comes to building community solar arrays,
we're probably going to do less than half of what we had originally hoped to install this year. And that's problematic for all the Vermonters that wanted to participate. And it's certainly problematic for us as a business. We're making significant and serious adjustments given the reality.
The Vermont Public Service Board is currently working on rewriting the net metering rules, which will define how and at what rate solar energy producers get paid by utilities. And Vermont solar advocates are holding their breath as many of their projects hang in the balance. For Here and Now, I'm Kathleen Masterson.
The list of cities suffering mass shootings has grown, and on Saturday, Chattanooga marks 1 year since joining that list. When we were in Nashville for the primary in March, Here Now's Alex Ashlock went to Chattanooga for this report.
They call Chattanooga Scenic City, and when you visit, you can see why. It's set along the Tennessee River, in the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains. During the Civil War, Union and rebel forces fought for control of the city. When Chattanooga fell to the Northern troops in November 1863, a Southern soldier wrote, "This is the death knell of the Confederacy." Last summer, a different kind of death knell could be heard in this city.
We are following breaking news right now. A shooting reported at
one of the early news reports on July 16, 2015, about the events that would shock Chattanooga. A man who would later be identified as Muhammad Yusuf Abdulaziz opened fire at a military recruitment center, where he wounded one officer. He then drove to the Navy Operational Support Center a few miles away and kept shooting. Before he was killed by police, Abdulaziz shot four Marines to death and mortally wounded a sailor. Chattanooga Mayor Andy Burke spoke during a news conference that afternoon.
Today is a nightmare for the city of Chattanooga. Around 11 o'clock this morning, we had someone viciously attack at two different locations, people who proudly serve our country.
The nightmare of that day has faded, but the scars and memories remain. Cars and trucks whiz by the recruitment center on Lee Highway Saturday morning, the scene of the first attack. The center is in a strip mall. It looks like any other storefront. But across the parking lot, there's a memorial to the men who died in the shooting.
Nothing at all. I mean, it was, just like any other day. It was normal. It was. We were all excited, because I think later that day we were going to go out and in the community and talk to, young men and women like we do all the time.
That's Staff Sergeant Winfield Thompson. He was on duty that day when everything changed in a heartbeat as Abdulaziz started firing at the center from his car.
First thing, we heard a pop. We heard the first pop, and I thought, maybe it was some firecrackers or something like that. Then I would say maybe a couple seconds after that, it just more pops continued, and it went pretty rapid. And that's when we understood we were getting fired upon. We took cover, and then once we heard the pause in the shooting, once we heard that pause, we got out of there.
It all happened so fast, a matter of minutes. Then the shooter was gone, on his way to the Navy Center. Andy Burke is still Chattanooga's mayor. In his office Saturday morning, he told me the shootings are just about impossible to forget.
It's hard to comprehend the magnitude of what happened that day. We had four heroes at that moment who had served our country, who had passed away. It took a while to make sense of it, and I think everybody here still struggles with that.
Born in Kuwait, Abdulaziz was an American citizen and had been in the U.S. with his family since the mid-1990s. He had graduated from Red Bank High School in a Chattanooga suburb. Again, Chattanooga Mayor Andy Burke.
This attacker, unfortunately, grew up in this country. And what we have to do is understand the horrible and twisted ways that he ended up where he did.
Abdulaziz did have drug and alcohol problems and had been treated for depression, and there were signs of radicalization. The shooting was investigated as terrorism. President Obama spoke to the nation on December 6 last year, after another shooting, the one in San Bernardino, that left 14 people dead. He said the terrorist threat had evolved into a new phase.
As we've become better at preventing complex, multifaceted attacks like 9/11, terrorists turn to less complicated acts of violence, like the mass shootings that are all too common in our society. It is this type of attack that we saw at Fort Hood in 2009, in Chattanooga earlier this year, and now in San Bernardino. And as groups like ISIL grew stronger amidst the chaos of war in Iraq and then Syria, and as the internet erases the distance between countries, we see growing efforts by terrorists to poison the minds of people like the Boston Marathon bombers and the San Bernardino killers.
The recruiting office that was the scene of the first attack was closed when I left Chattanooga. The parking lot was empty, except for a family that came to pay their respects. Cheryl Bean grew up in Chattanooga and said she had been here before.
We came when they had the memorial set up, and it was really overwhelming. To see all the flags and the mementos people left, flowers and things. It's just, you don't think it can happen in your hometown.
The men who were killed by the Chattanooga shooter were Sergeant Carson Holmquist, Gunnery Sergeant Thomas Sullivan, Lance Corporal Squire Skip Wells, Staff Sergeant David Wyatt, and Navy Petty Officer Randall Smith. They were awarded Purple Hearts because the government ruled the attacks were inspired by a foreign terrorist organization. For Here and Now, I'm Alex Ashlock in Nashville.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.